idea to the Haggadah and to getting out of Egypt, and I think it's a more intuitive idea. And then the second one is one that I think takes the Haggadah in a direction that people don't often think about. So the first one is meant for the Tse Ulamad paragraph of the Haggadah. It's really the start of what I think of as the essence of Magid. Because, you know, in the beginning of Magid, we spend time talking about leaving Mitzrayim. So we have Mahadishtana, we have stories about other people telling the story, we have a debate about when you're supposed to talk about Yitzias Mitzrayim. And then we start talking about how our ancestors started out as Ovdei Avodah Zarah, as idolaters. They went down to Mitzrayim, Vehisha Amda, and every generation Hashem protects us. And then we get to Tse Ulamad. And Tse Ulamad is really where Magid starts, in the sense that we invoke the psukim from Parashas Kisavo, Arami Oved Aviv, Ayered Mitzrayim, where Sefer Devarim recounts for us the story of getting out of him. And that's what we use as the scaffold on which we tell the story. So if you take a look at source number one, I brought you Tse Ulamad. Tse Ulamad ma bikesh Lavan ha'arami la'asos li'Yaakov Avinu. Go out and learn what Lavan wanted to do to our ancestor Yaakov. Shepara lo gazar ela al hazicharim v'Lavan bikesh la'akor es hakol. Paro only decreed to destroy the baby boys, throw them in the river. Lavan, on the other hand, wanted to uproot everything. Now, I don't intend to talk about where we find that Lavan wanted to uproot everything. It's really not so clear. The simplest take, I think, is when he goes pursuing Yaakov after Yaakov flees, but there are different explanations. I want to focus on what's coming next. Shenamar, we quote the pasuk from Parshas Kisavo, Arami Oved Avi, Vayered Mitzrayimah Vayagar Sham Bimseimaat, Vayisham Legoy Gadol Atzum Varav. The Haggadah translates that as, an Aramean tried to destroy my father, he descended to Egypt, dwelled there in small numbers, and there he became a large, mighty, and great nation. That sentence that says, Arami Oved Avi, can actually be translated in multiple ways. Right? Alina's nodding her head, yes. Besides saying that the Arami is Lavan, who else could it be? For Arami Oved Avi.
Could it be Asaph?
Well, Asaph's not an Aramean. Right? Who else do we know who is an Aramean? So Abraham is an Aramean. And the word Oved, for the Hebrew speakers, does not have to mean try to destroy at all, right? What should the word Oved mean grammatically?
Lost?
Yeah, lost. Lost, wandering. The Oved, frankly, if I wanted to say try to destroy, I would have done something more along the lines of Ebed. Oved sounds more like lost. So that Rashbam says Arami Oved Avi means my father was a wandering Aramean. Because my father, Abraham, left Aram to go to Israel. Or you have the view of Ibn Ezra, who says it's Yaakov. Yaakov lived in Aram when he was with Lavan, and then Arami Oved Avi. So my ancestor Yaakov was wandering in Aram by Yered Mitzrayim, and he went down to Egypt, which fits very nicely, because of course Yaakov did go down to Egypt. Abram did briefly also. But in any case, the Haggadah is following the view of the Ritva, of the Avudraham, that Arami Oved Avi means Lavan, the Aramean, tried to destroy my father. And here's my problem. It's not so much about the trying to destroy my father, it's the next line. Vayered Mitzrayimah, and he went down to Egypt. And my question is, what did Lavan do that made us go down to Egypt? Right? Where's the connection between those two stories? That's our question for your Haggadah, right? If you're thinking about this in terms of when am I going to say this at my Seder, you're in Seyulamad. We say an Aramean tried to destroy my father and we went down to Mitzrayim. Wait, stop the presses. What does one thing have to do with the other? I know what Lavan did. Take a look at source number two. Here is my list of Lavan's averos. Okay, first of all, he made Yaakov work for him for 7 years to marry Rachel. That wasn't so nice. Then, Yaakov has finished his 7 years, thinks he's marrying Rachel, and in fact, he's marrying Leah. That's not good either. Then, Yaakov finds out that he's married Leah, wants to marry Rachel, and Laban says, okay, work for me for another 7 years. You can marry Rachel, right? Wait 1 week, Sheva Brachas for Leah, marry Rachel, but you're going to have to work for another 7 years. Then, we are told that Laban tries to cheat Yaakov of his salary. Right? Yaakov says tenfold. And then finally, Yaakov, Rachel, Leah, the family have had enough, and they flee. And Laban goes running after Yaakov until Hashem appears to him and says, leave him alone. That's my list of things that Laban did to Yaakov. Do any of these cause Yaakov to go down to Mitzrayim? You might as well have said, Esav wanted to kill Yaakov, and he went down to Mitzrayim. Right? Where is the link for Lavan in this story? It's very strange, no? A couple of years ago, I was giving a class about Lavan, and I came across this source, in source number three. It was a fellow by the name of Harry Friedman. Talks about Lavan. And he says, Lavan is certainly a trickster. He tricks Yaakov into marrying Leah instead of Rachel. He changes Yaakov's wages 10 times, though what he actually did is not spelled out, which is true. But being a trickster is not so unusual in Bereishis. Right? Everyone plays games in Bereishis. Why is Lavan singled out for special treatment? After all, as the father of Rachel and Leah, he is as much an ancestor of Israel as is Yitzchak. But don't shout that out too loud. Now, that's not quite true, right? Because Yitzchak is the total father of Yaakov, and therefore full grandfather for everybody. We have some of our Shvatim who come from Bilhah and Zilpah, unless you take the Medrash that Bilhah and Zilpah are also daughters of Lavan, in which case you're right. Lavan is every bit the grandfather that Yitzchak is, which is something to think about. But leaving aside the question of just how much of our family depends on Lavan, we're pinning an awful lot on him, saying that somehow what he did to Yaakov is tied to our descent to Mitzrayim. So tell me, how does Lavan take us down to Mitzrayim? In order to understand how Lavan led to Mitzrayim, we need to think about what a nation needs. What does it take to build a nation? So take a look at source number four, article by Alvin Powell, How to Build a Nation, quoting Francis Fukuyama, the political scientist. He has Francis Fukuyama, who in 1992 famously predicted, quote, the end of history because liberal democracies and free market economies suggested an endpoint in the evolution of government, none of that is relevant for us, said that external forces can erect a skeleton of state in an embattled country, creating police forces, administrative structures, taxing authorities. You can come into an area where a population lives and give them all of the tools for running a country. You can do that. But nation building goes further and involves a shared sense of national identity built on elements that tie people together, such as shared culture, language, and history that cannot be imposed from without. Right? When you think about what the League of Nations and then the UN tried to do in the Middle East, where they said, okay, here's going to be Syria, and here's going to be Iraq, and here's going to be Iran, and they tried to create nations of people who had not been a nation before, right? Go ask the Kurds. You can't just say, okay, now you're a political entity, and here is your system of government, and here is your police force, and here are your hospitals, and whatever it is, and poof, you're a country. It doesn't work that way. You need shared culture, you need shared language, you need shared history. And I found actually this great study in source number five, I just gave you a link for it, It's a study on how people from different nationalities view the essence of national identity. What do you have to have in common in order to be part of a nation? And they interview Americans, Canadians, Europeans, Australians, and Japanese, and, you know, to see what they each, what each group believes is necessary in order to see yourself as part of a nation. But there's one more element beyond the shared culture, language, and history, and Ernest Gellner in source number 6 says it, you need also nationalism. He talks about it in terms of nationalism as something artificial, but nationalism is necessary. There has to be a sense that we are all one group. What Fukuyama says in source number 7, a prior sense of moral community. You have to have a sense of we are all one, right? The basis of social trust. You follow? That's what you need. Yes, Hannah, what?
Could Lavan have ruined the honesty by putting Leia as the first wife or mother of the children? And then if it had been Rachel first, Yosef would have been the Bechor or the ruler. And since he wasn't, but he tried to become, they got jealous, they kicked him out and sent him to, his brother sent him to Mitzrayim. But it was in turn because Lavan initiated that whole trickery.
Good. So that's a step. I think it's a very interesting read. I'm going to go in a slightly different direction. But along those lines, what Lavan does is fundamentally to undermine the trust between them, right? You're pointing out he's undermining the trust between them because he puts Leia ahead and therefore Yosef isn't the firstborn. And I think that's a fascinating way to read it. But I would argue bigger. The whole introduction of Leia. If Lavan never swaps in Leia, how many wives does Yaakov end up with?
Two.
Why two?
So he'll have Rachel and the Pilegesh.
But why will he even have a Pilegesh? He only marries Bilhah because Rachel is jealous of Leia. Right? Leia has kids. Rachel doesn't have kids. Rachel says, fine, take my Pilegesh. Right? Take my Shivcha. Whether she's a Pilegesh or not depends on which pasuk in the Torah you're looking at. Bilhah ends up with being characterized in different ways. But the point is, Lavan introduces the split in the family. It's all Lavan's goal. I mean, it's not his goal, it's his role. It's not Lavan's goal. Why did Lavan switch in Leia for Rachel fundamentally? What was Lavan trying to do?
He just agreed. He just wanted him to work longer.
Yeah. He just wanted 7 more years of work. That was his entire goal. Meaning, I saw somebody write that it was because he knew the family of Yaakov has brachos, and Rivka got those brachos when she went in, so he wants his daughters to marry into this family so that his descendants will you know, be there, and this way Leia won't have to marry Esav. And those are all fine ideas, but Rachel and Leia were very, very clear. When Yaakov comes to Rachel and Leia, and he says to them, I think I got to get out of here, is this okay? And they say about their father, Ki Micharanu, he sold us. As far as Rachel and Leia are concerned, it's what Goldie said. The reason why Lavan did the swap was because he wanted another 7 years of labor out of Yaakov. But whatever his intentions were, he triggered the split. Because as a result of swapping in Leah for Rachel, you end up with the addition of Bilhah, you end up with the addition of Zilpah, you end up with these 12 sons and at least one daughter who are split between each other. it leads to strife. It leads to strife between Yaakov and his wives. Rachel lashes out at Yaakov because I can't have children, and Leah is having children. Rachel acquires the Dudaim from Leah, and Leah says, he's my husband, right? You try to take my husband, now you take these Dudaim as well. And the result of it is that we stop viewing ourselves as one nation, and we start instead to identify based on different mothers, right? Think about it. The descendants of Yaakov, identify based on which mother they come from. When they go to meet Esav, we have Rachel and her kids, and Leah and her kids, and Bilhah and her kids, and Zilpah and her kids. Each one is identified that way. When Rachel dies, right, we have that whole medrash about Reuven moving Yaakov's bed from Bilhah's tent into Leah's tent. They identify based on their mothers. In the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, right before Yosef is sold, we are told, "V'hu na'ar es b'nei Bilhah v'es b'nei Zilpah." He was hanging out with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, or he was serving with them, unclear. But the point is, they're identified as, these are Leah's kids, these are Rachel's kids, these are Bilhah's kids, these are Zilpah's kids. Laban may be the grandfather, but he's a grandfather who created a terrible split in the family. You follow? So, what does this have to do with going down to Mitzrayim? Well, Rav Zalman Sorotzkin, in his Haggadah, Hashir v'Hashevach, says that Hashem sends us to Egypt for us to learn the tools to unify ourselves. He doesn't go through the whole Lavan discussion. That's something I'm putting in. But he says we needed two keys to become a mature nation and be able to function independently. One was unity, and the other is the willingness to follow the instructions of a common government. He quotes a pasuk in Mishlei, which I brought you here in source number 8. B'chol eis ohev hareya, v'ach letzara yivaled. A brother is born from trouble. Your friend will become like a brother to you when you are in trouble. We would learn unity by being in trouble together. We would also learn humility, which would help us to follow a common authority. And the idea is that once we gain some measure of that unity, it's time for us to go. Time for us to get out of Mitzrayim. And you see that in multiple ways. Hashem answers us and says, I'm going to get you out when we cry out. But as it's told in Parshas Kisavo, it's Vanitzak El Hashem, and we cried out. Or as it's told in Shmos, Vayizaku, and they cried out. Take a look at the Nitziv in source number 9, please, on the sheet. Niskabtsu kulam lemakom echad. They gathered to one place, the Jews in Egypt. They gathered. He's envisioning not individual Jews crying out in their work, but rather the Jews assembled, v'hiskimu lamo l'tfila u'litza'aka, and they decided to stand in prayer and cries. They held a kenes. They got together. They said, okay, we're going to now call out to Hashem. To which I would add the business about the shotrim, those Jews who have been appointed in charge of other Jews who refused to strike the other Jews. They absorb the blows that are meant for their brethren. Vayuku shotrei b'nei Yisrael. Even the fact that when Moshe comes to Paro, Paro gets angry and he says, I'm doubling the workload and they're not going to get their straw and all that. The Jews yell at Moshe, but they don't turn him into Paro. Right? There's a level of unity that develops in Mitzrayim. And Rav Sorotzkin suggests, if you take a look at source number 10, that that's the message in Matzah. He says, Urufuas Hama, he has this fascinating idea. Rav Zalman Sorotzkin, for those who are not familiar, lived in Israel. And he was born in Ukraine, early 20th century, but ultimately makes Aliyah, comes to Israel, and was a Rosh Hashiva there for many years. He has this very funny idea about how atom gravity and like all of physics. It's very interesting, but you'll see part of it sort of make it into this. He says, water naturally spreads apart as a liquid. As he puts it, the atoms of water naturally spread apart. And he says flour also naturally spreads apart, right? We know this. If you ever tried to, you know, clean up the mess after flour goes everywhere. Flour also naturally spreads apart. So he says, Urufuas hamayim mitchuna sam hara'a al yedei iruv bekemach. He says, the way you heal water from its bad trait of separating is by mixing it with flour. Rak az bitucha ushlema. Only then is it secure and whole. Im tasimet ha'isa tekef leblilai la tanur. If, right after mixing the dough, you put it in the oven, v'lo tasim bi'isa sa'or, and you don't add an agent to it to make it rise. Avalim tasim seor beisa, but if you add an agent to the dough, osha taniachos as man meruba, or you leave it for a long time below esek v'tipul miyuchad without doing anything to work it, terem shetasim osa betanur until you place it in the oven, as yatchilu atomei hamei meriva lashuv le'etanam. Then the atoms of the water of quarreling mei meriva, the expression used in the Torah, will return to their origin. He says by putting the water and the flour together and baking it right away, you defeat the scattering, which is native to water and to flour, and which returns when they start to rise. You catch it in that interim, you catch them right then, they're unified. And he says that's what the Jews were like at that point. We get out of Mitzrayim when we have hit that level of unity, the desired unity. Is that clear? You follow? So, what we have so far, just in terms of your Seder Dvar Torah, is how did Lavan lead to us going down to Mitzrayim? Lavan triggers the need for unity. Because he creates a situation in which we see ourselves as part of tribes, instead of seeing ourselves as unified. Reuven from Leah, and Yosef from Rachel, are going to see themselves as different. We need to see each other as one. That's what we needed to gain by going down to Mitzrayim. So it's not that Lavan sent us there, but Lavan triggered the need for us to go there. Now, in truth, this is a bit more complicated. I wouldn't suggest necessarily starting this part of it at your Seder, unless you want people to throw things at you. But it is an important part of the idea, because the idea is more complicated than the drive for unity. Because the Torah does preserve tribalism. You can't get around that. Lavan is fundamentally successful in that regard. First of all, as Zalman Sarutzkin points out, we seize the moment when we're unified then. But later on, we rise, so to speak, and the dough starts to spread and to scatter. There's plenty of strife later on in Navi as we try to go off in different directions. And the Torah even preserves that tribalism. When we travel in the Midbar, right, each tribe is led by its own Nasi. You have Digalim. You have these flags around which each one, each tribe has its own flag, marking itself as unique. And then you have camps in which you have camps of three Shvatim each, of three tribes each, and Leah's kids go first. And then after that, you get Rachel's kids, Bilhah and Zilpah mixed in a little bit to make the numbers work. But it's fundamentally divided based on the mothers. We get into Israel. Yoshua builds a monument of 12 stones to mark where we crossed the Yarden. 12 stones because of 12 Shvatim. I even noted for you on the sheet, the Medrash in source number 11, when we crossed through the Yamsuf, we had 12 channels, right? Each Shevet gets its own spot. So you can't really say that we were eliminating all tribalism and preserving only unity. That's what I mean when I say the idea is a little bit more complicated. There's value in preserving that which makes us unique. And if you were to look at source number 12, you'd see links to a longer set of shiurim that I gave where I talked about this more. But my point here, to go back to the core of our Torah, is that Lavan introduced tribalism into the Jewish people by marrying off Leah to Yaakov, that split the children of each wife from each other, led to the sale of Yosef, led to us going down to Mitzrayim. And in Mitzrayim, we were meant to learn that unity and trust that Fukuyama and Gellner talk about that enable us to become a nation. And you know, we may be tribes, but we still have to see each other as one. And the last note that I have here is the number 13. Rabbi Chiya Michal Epstein, in his Aruch HaShulchan, his introduction to Choshen Mishpat, has this beautiful line talking about Torah, and Torah being a song. And he says, V'tiferes hashir, the splendor of a song, hikisha kolos mishunim zemizeh, is when the voices are all different from each other. V'zeo ikar hani'imut, that is the essence of its appeal. We do preserve that tribalism that Lavan created, but we have to see ourselves as fundamentally creating one song. That it's all going, you know, in harmony towards one goal. Clear? Okay. So yeah, we did this shiur on Vayeshev a few years back, where we talked about how the split of the of Rachel and Leah ends up going down through the generations, through their descendants, and the Yehuda Yisrael split. So that was a key part of for me in building that idea. Okay, so let's move into the second idea, unless there are comments, questions from the first. Nope, we're good? Okay. So the second idea is in some ways simpler and in some ways more technical. Well, it's both. It's simpler, relies on some technical knowledge. So nonetheless, I think it's a great idea for this year, Davka at the Seder, as I'm going to explain. With this Dvar Torah, we're going to explore pairs, P-A-I-R-S, pairs. Two sides of our freedom, which play out in two ways in the Beis HaMikdash and in two aspects of our lives as Jews today. This Dvar Torah comes at the end of Magid. So you remember you have Rabban Gamliel? Right, you have to say these three things, Pesach, Matzah, Maror. And then you have Bechol Dor Vador. In every generation, you have to see yourself or demonstrate that you are leaving Egypt. And then you have a paragraph of Lefichach. Therefore, we are obligated to thank God in various ways for all he has done for us. And then you have the two opening paragraphs of Hallel. Right? This rings a bell, right? Okay. And then the closing bracha of Hallel is Asher Ge'alanu, in which you bridge past and present and future, thanking Hashem for the redemption we experienced, expressing our longing to celebrate again in the Beis HaMikdash. There's actually a nice Dvar Torah in the Seder Companion that we put out this year. This is the first year I can't give you I can't give you copies of the Seder Companion. They're around. They're in the shuls. But I won't be. Actually, Hadassah, if you wanted, I could get you a bunch of copies that people could pick up from you.
We printed ours.
Oh, okay.
But I'm happy to distribute.
All right, let me know if you want some copies. I can still get you some.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So the after this bracha of Asher Ge'alanu, then you make your bracha on the second cup. So this Dvar Torah is about Asher Ge'alanu. However, I would advocate for giving it a little bit earlier in the Seder, like right after Pesach Matzah Maror. The reason being, some people's Haggadahs tell them that they should pick up the cup at like Lefichach and hold it until the end of Asher Ge'alanu, and they don't want you starting a Dvar Torah while they're standing there, you know, holding their, or sitting there holding their cup of wine in the air. So so it's probably a good idea to give it a little bit earlier. But the question is this. As we're going to see in a moment, the bracha of Asher Ge'alanu says that we bring two karbanos on Pesach, on the for the night of Pesach, not just the karban Pesach, but another one as well. And what I want to know is why we are bringing not one karban but two karbanos. Take a look at source number one. This is from that bracha of Asher Ge'alanu. We say, Baruch Hashem, right? Asher ge'alanu v'ga'ales avoseinu. He redeemed us. He redeemed our ancestors, mi Mitzrayim, from Egypt. V'gi'anu alayla hazeh le'chol bo matzah u'maror. He brought us on this night to eat matzah and maror. Kein Hashem Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu yagi'enu l'moadim v'lergalim achirim haba'im l'krasenu l'shalom. So may Hashem, our God, God of our ancestors, bring us to other festivals, which are coming upon us in peace. Smeichem b'vinyan irecha, sasim b'avodasecha, rejoicing in the building of Yerushalayim and in serving Hashem. And there we get, v'nochal sham min hazivachim u'min ha'pesachim. And there, in the Beis HaMikdash, we will eat from the zivachim and from the psachim. So psachim is obviously the Korban Pesach. Anybody know what the zivachim are? Yes. So the Zvachim, good. The Zvachim is a reference to the Karban Chagiga, a celebration offering of the variety usually called a Shlamim. As a matter of fact, the Gemara in Psachim in source number 3 says this is why we have the Zroa and Beitza on the Ka'ara, on the Seder plate. Although it wasn't always a Zroa and Beitza, it was simply two cooked foods. So one was supposed to represent the Karban Pesach, and the other was supposed to represent the Karban Chagiga. It's very interesting always to note for people, if you look at source number 3, which is where the Gemara says it, that Rav Huna's two cooked foods were beets and rice. I don't know if people are more shocked by the vegetarianism of it or by him eating kidneys. But of course, this was long before kidneys was a thing. So the point is, though, that we have these two karbanos. Now, here's why I say that you should do this year specifically, because this year in many Haggados, actually, you know what? I'm sorry, I'm not quite up to that yet. Let me first explain the way it is, and then I'll explain what's unique about this year. We mention in the bracha the zvachim before the psachim, and the reason for that is because we have a mitzvah of eating the Karban Pesach when we are full. Right? Al Hasova. You're really supposed to eat all karbanos to the point of being full, but the Karban Pesach uniquely, we are told, you have to make sure to eat it when you are full. We commemorate that at our Seder with the Afikoman. So we eat the Afikoman at the end. It's supposed to represent eating from the Karban Pesach. But when we have a Beis HaMikdash and we're bringing karbanos, the way it works is you eat a little bit of the Karban Pesach to start with, then you have the Karban Chagiga to get you to the point of being ready to be full, and then you eat the Karban Pesach at the very end. Right? The Karban Pesach is small. Keep in mind, it's a yearling lamb, right? Or a yearling goat. But it's not big, and it's spread among the family. So this way, you'll be able to fill up a little bit more by having the Chagiga. So that's why we say in the bracha, there we shall eat from the Zvachim, from the Chagiga, umin ha-psachim, and then we're going to complete it by having from the Karban Pesach. Clear? Everyone with me? Not too technical? Sometimes people hear karbanos, they automatically tune out. That's what the bracha is describing for us. I brought you Tosfos, who says it in source number 4, that we do the zvachim, and then we say the psachim, because you have to eat the Karban Pesach when you are full. The Mordechai actually quotes a Yerushalmi, which I brought you in source number 5, which gives a different explanation for why you're supposed to do this, and it's because you want to make sure you don't break a bone in the Karban Pesach. The Karban Pesach is eaten without breaking any bones. Let me explain, because I didn't say this before. You're supposed to eat the Karban Pesach like royalty, right? That's the idea. So number 1, somebody who is regal doesn't keep stuff over for eating as leftovers the next day. You eat everything. You don't say, well, you know what? Let me stop short of being full in order to save the food for later. So that's why you eat it to the point of being full. That's number 1. And then number 2, the breaking of a bone of the karban, somebody who isn't able to get satisfaction from the meat of the karban will also break the bones to get the marrow that's inside. So therefore, you're not supposed to break the bones of the Korban Pesach. You're supposed to show that this is something that you're doing royally. And so, once again, eat the Korban Chagiga first to make sure you're going to be full and you won't come to break a bone of the Korban Pesach. That's what the Yerushalmi in source number 5 says. So, it's Svachim first, Psachim second. Chagiga first to make sure you're full and you won't break a bone from the Korban Pesach. That's the idea. Now I get to the point that's unique this year. Any of you actually have a Haggadah with you or no? Okay, that's fine. I don't think I said in the email that you had to have a Haggadah with you. But if you were to look in a Haggadah at this bracha, what you would probably find is a note in parentheses after what I brought you in source number 1. Right after those words, V'nochal sham min hazvachim u min hapsachim, you will find in most Haggadahs, it will say, B'motzai Shabbos, that when your Seder is Saturday night, then you flip it and say, min hapsachim u min hazvachim. Not everybody actually flips it, but every Haggadah says that we flip it. And the idea behind flipping it is because when Shabbos is Erev Pesach, you can only shecht the Korban Pesach on Shabbos. You don't shecht the Korban Chagiga on Shabbos. So therefore, it's not going to be Zvachim and Psachim this year. So that's why this is a good Dvar Torah for this year, because you get to point out that unique element. We're not doing the Korban Chagiga this year. But with all of this as background, and I recognize that 8 minutes of background is a lot of background for people at the Seder, so you might want to find a way to kind of scrunch it a little bit. You could start off your Dvar Torah by simply saying, we're going to say here that there are two karbanos. There's the chagiga in a normal year, and then there's the Korban Pesach, so that will be full. When we eat the Korban Pesach, we eat it like royalty, right? But then here's my question. You didn't need a Korban chagiga in order to be full when you have the Korban Pesach. Do you know what you could do if you want it to be full when you get to the Korban Pesach? Eat other stuff. You didn't eat a Korban. Why did it have to be a Korban at all? If you want to be full, eat other food. If you take a look at source number 6, the Rambam talks about this. In talking about eating Korbanos, I told you that in general you're supposed to eat a Korban to the point of being full. So the Rambam gives you advice on how to be full. He says in source number 6, Haisalam hachila mu'etes, if there's too little food from the Korban, ochlen ima chulen utrumos, so eat other things. Eat regular food, eat truma, whatever. K'dei shein achelas alasova, so that the Korban will be eaten when you're full. I didn't need a Korban chagiga for this purpose. I could eat whatever I want. I could eat a lot of matzah. Maybe not a great idea. But like you can do whatever you like in order to be, like, why do you have a Korban chagiga? Does everyone understand the question? Right? The question is a simple question. It just takes a while to get there because we need to understand what these korbanos are about. So why do I need a Korban chagiga? So you could just give a kind of basic answer and say it's because it elevates the Seder when you have an additional Korban. You make all of your eating sacrificial. And that's a nice idea. But I think there's something else that's going on here. Writing in a different context, the Kloisenberger Rebbe, the Divrei Yatziv, Rabbi Kil Yehuda Halberstam, offered a very interesting insight into the way royalty works. I brought you an excerpt of it in source number 7, but I'm going to say it outside. He's talking about the requirement for karbanos of eating them, certain karbanos of eating them when they're roasted, which is also meant to reflect royalty. The idea that when you roast something over an open fire, yeah, things drip into the fire and you lose them, as opposed to you boil it in a pot where you preserve everything. But he makes the following interesting point. He says, there are two different ways to be a king, or queen, if you like. On the one hand, the stereotype of royalty is they get to do whatever they want. Right? Like the Gemara says, Melech Poreitz Lo Geder. The king can break through property. The king can commandeer resources. The king can say, okay, I need slaves now, so I'm taking these people and they're going to be my slaves. The king can take the nation to war. Kings can do whatever they want. Right? That's sort of one way to look at being a king. But it's not the whole truth. Right? I feel like this sort of reflects what went on in the news last week, the week before, out of England. There's another piece to being royal, right? It means having to participate in a lot of formalities and ceremonies where you don't get to decide what you're going to do. They're going to tell you what you're going to wear. They're going to tell you where you're going to go. They're going to tell you who you're going to say hello to and how you're going to say hello to them, right? There are rules that come with being royalty, and it's counterintuitive because we're used to thinking of royalty as powerful and they can do whatever they want, but there are trappings, literally, that come with power. Royalty is required to follow certain rules. Even in the Gemara, they talk about the requirement of a king having a haircut every day so that he can look just so. So when we left Mitzrayim, we gained both of these types of monarchy. On the one hand, the Egyptians no longer controlled our lives, right? We can do whatever we want. Shalach ami, Hashem says, send out my nation. But that line, Shalach Ami, ends V'ya'avduni, and they will serve me. We also received mitzvos, duties that are presented as this royal role of being Mamlachas Kohanim, a nation of priests. These duties are not up to us, right? Pesach celebrates Hashem selecting us without our agreement. No Jewish slave in Egypt said, I want a brit, I want a land. They said, get me out of here. They're crying out because they're suffering. End the suffering. You know, so much so that when Moshe fails initially to get them out, they say, go away. You're making things worse. We'd rather stay here. Pesach is not about the realization of a national dream. Pesach is about the extraction of slaves from their milieu and their metamorphosis into the royalty that is Yisrael. And to me, that's what you see in these two karbanos. Meaning the karbanos highlight both elements of liberation. The karban chagiga is an anything goes karban in many ways. If you take a look at the last source on the sheet, source number 8, the Rambam in his Hilchos Karban Pesach brings you the laws for this karban chagiga. And look what he says. He says, Makrivanimo shlamim b'yom yadalet, on the 14th of Nisan, you bring a shlamim with the Karban Pesach. It can be min habakar o min hatzon. It can be from cattle, it can be from sheep, it can be goat, lamb, cow, bull, whichever animal you want. It can be gedolim o ketanim. It can be older, it can be younger, doesn't matter how old the animal is. Zicharim o nekevos, it can be male, it can be female, just like any shlamim, he says. It may be, there's a debate in the Gemara, but it's possible that it doesn't even have to be roasted. And fundamentally, the whole chagiga is optional. It's not a requirement, which is why you do away with it when it's Shabbos. So you have this carbon chagiga, which represents volition, the king doing whatever the king wants to do. I'm free. And then you have the carbon Pesach, which is very, very specific. It's only goat or lamb, it's only a yearling, it's only male, it's only roasted, and you do not have a choice. It is one of two mitzvot aseh in the Torah that have the penalty of karet for failure to observe them. The Karban Pesach is royal ceremony par excellence. You follow? So you have these two different elements to it. To go back again to what our question and our answer are, right? We're eating from the zvachim and the psachim. The zvachim, the carbon chagiga that we eat, so that we'll be full when we get to the carbon Pesach. Why do I need a carbon to make sure I'm full? I could eat other stuff to make sure I'm full. Yeah, but there's symbolism here. The chagiga represents the royal freedom to do whatever I want. The Pesach represents the obligations that come with royalty to be Hashem's nation. That was really quick. I think that it's important, though, beyond the Seder, because this shapes our lives as Jews today. In the spirit of the Karban Pesach, we have mitzvos that we perform at particular times, in particular locations, in particular ways, right? You have to, you know, the tefillin have to look just like this. This is what you do. Cooking on Shabbos has to be just like this. There are limitations. But in the spirit of the Karban Chagiga, we also celebrate free will and individuality. With all of us and with all of our mitzvos, we have room to be mystics and rationalists, scholars, community organizers, balei chesed, theologians or scientists. The breadth of who you can be within Torah is extremely, extremely broad. That's the Chagiga. It celebrates choice. While the mitzvos and their specifics are the Korban Pesach. So when we say this bracha, and we call to mind the Zvachim and the Psachim, or the Psachim and the Zvachim, whichever way you're going to end up saying it this year, fundamentally, we commit to harness both sides of our religious personality, to follow the rules we're given and the rituals as specified, and to live a full life which expresses our personalities freely in the service of Hashem. And God willing, the Pesach and the Chagiga should continue through the year to be part of that the relationship with Hashem. Okay?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.